Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Holocaust survivor Milton Kleinberg, owner and chief executive officer of Senior Market Sales Incorporated in Omaha, Nebraska, which employs over 100 people in four states and two countries, the United States and Israel, and author of Memories of My Childhood, During and After the Holocaust, 1937 to 1951, which traces Mr. Kleinberg and his family's escape from Nazi-occupied Poland in 1939 and their subsequent capture and internment in the Soviet Union. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday afternoon, July 8, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Institute for Holocaust Education, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to tell his incredible story is Holocaust survivor Milton Kleinberg.
Thank you all for coming. Chad, would you stand up? Chad, Chad is responsible for putting this book together. My daughter did the cover. My granddaughter did the back cover, but Chad, he put it. Thank you. Is that all you got? but Chad did a wonderful job of putting the book together. It's a big, good quality book that everybody has remarked how nicely and how well it's put together. We also have a Hebrew version of this book. I don't speak Hebrew, but the people say I write a beautiful Hebrew. That's mostly for Israel, for our family in Israel. We spread the Hebrew book we gave out. Our first printing of the book was done small numbers because I never anticipated that this book would catch on. We just did it as for our children and grandchildren, you know, a little history for them, so they can understand what happened during that period of time. And when we started giving the book to just small numbers, they kept on passing it around, and now we have in some families the book went from one to the other, well, all the places. And of course, the people from Yad Vashem and the people from the Holocaust Museum, when they read the book, they also felt that it deserves being talked about in educational circles and people who talk about the Holocaust and teach the Holocaust. The one aspect about the Holocaust that this book makes a little bit different is the fact that most of the Holocaust books are written about the concentration camp, and justifiably so. But very little is written about the Holocaust, the Soviet Union's participation in the Holocaust. They had a big hand in it, but nobody talks about it, nobody mentions about it. So when I written about our trip through the Soviet Union and some of the camps that we were in there, it caught on, so people got more interested in the book. Another thing with this book, because it was going to be just for family members, I did not do all the appropriate footnotes and things that required to be in there. I think you reminded me of this when you read the book. So when we redid it, we had our own maps. We did the footnotes. We made sure that everything in here is up to the standards what a quality book should be. So this is the book, and so far we're not reprinting the hardcover since it's already out there, and we're making it available free of charge to the Holocaust Museum, to Holocaust Education. The biggest problem I have is I don't know where to start, because there are actually three stories in this one story. The story what happened before the war, during the war, and after the war. And they're all sort of pulling in different directions. So it was a very difficult book to start, but I will start with, of course, when I was born. What the heck? As all of you know, my name is Milton M. Kleinberg. The M stands for Mendel. We have another Mendel sitting here. Rabbi Katz is a Mendel. However, I was born Mendel Davidovich. That's about as Polish as you can get. And I was born in January 28, 1937, in Pabianice, Poland. Pabianice, Poland is in central Poland. It's a suburb of Lodz. Lodz is a very large city there. It's now a suburb, but it's about 10 kilometers or 6 miles from Lodz. In that little town, there were 24,000 people, one-third of them were Jews. It's the same thing with Lodz, except there they had 275,000 Jews, and they were one-third of the population as well. The story, of course, starts where we had a family. Within walking distance, we had a large, large family. Uncles, aunts, parents, grandparents, about 108 people of our immediate family were all within walking distance of our house on Kościelna 24 in Pabianice, Poland. And then, of course, came the war. The war is something that's very difficult to describe. Before Poland, the Jews lived in Poland for 1,000 years. Before the war in 1939, there were 3,300,000 Jews that were alive. After the war lasted 2,076 days. When the hostility stopped, there were only 300,000 left. So it's a catastrophe that you can't believe. When we left, we had a vibrant community, stores, people walking the streets, peddlers, noise, signs in Yiddish, signs in... there was a lot of movement. The city was always in motion, except for one day, which is Shabbat. When we came back after the war, we couldn't find a recognizable Jewish face in the whole town. But worse than anything else is the noise, the smell, the feel of Jewishness was gone. Yeah, I need water. Yeah, just bear with me. It was eerie when you don't see a street without a Jewish sign. But anyways, the world was turned upside down for us in September 1st, 1939, when the Germans attacked Poland. They came in from the west. About 17 days later, the Soviet Union attacked Poland from the east, and they divided Poland between them. That's the fourth time that the Germans and Austrians and the Russian and the Soviets have divided Poland between themselves. And that was the demarcation line where where you couldn't go beyond that. And Hitler and Stalin, who were allegedly big enemies, sort of made nice, and when they divided Poland, they agreed that they will not let anybody cross the border in either direction. And that made it very difficult to escape from Poland. And when the Germans came in 1939, about a week later, they were already in Lodz in Poland with their tanks. It didn't take them very much. And as soon as they got in there, they started isolating the Jewish community into a ghetto. And they gave us a choice: stay here or be deported. Now, they wanted the people out of central Poland for one reason, because the Germans annexed that part of Poland, and they didn't want any Jews in Germany to be called living in Germany. So they gave us a choice. You can leave, and leave as soon as you can. So for the poor, those that were poor, they got the Jewish community together and they told them, if you give them 50 zlotys, and so they can freely go. So at that time, we could still freely go. And our family, my father, my mother, and I had a younger brother. I'm going to get through this. And my younger brother, we were ordered to be deported. And they marched us to the train station. They packed us in cattle cars. And I mean cattle cars, because you could still smell the cattle. You could see the hay on the floor. The manure hasn't even been cleaned out. And they packed about 40 people into a cattle car, and they shipped us east towards the Russian border. And after a day and night flight without water, without food, they unloaded us and then marched us about 10 miles to a town called Salis. And there they put us into a burned synagogue. And the Jews who stayed in that burned synagogue realized that this is not the place to be. And of course, my mother was afraid they're going to burn us out again. So she started making friends and figure out a way to cross the river Bug into the Soviet Union. And my father used to play with pigeons, and he found a Pole who was a border guard that also liked pigeon, and he agreed to take us across the river. The river was freezing up, so we had to be find a day that we could find to cross the river. And we crossed the river, and a couple of bottles of vodka and some cigarettes, and the deal was closed. And then we were on the other side of the Soviet Union side. We were in a city called Berg, and that was an old Jewish community there. And we were trying to get into town and, you know, sort of blend into the Jewish community, because if you were just caught on the road, the Russians were not as vicious as the Germans, but they weren't nice people either. So we were arrested on the Russian side of the border, and they put us in a holding tank. When the Soviet Union occupied Poland, they automatically started arresting all the intellectuals, all the people with any kind of property. They called everybody a capitalist. And when we were arrested, they asked us if we want to become Russian citizens. And we refused to become Russian citizens, because once you become a Russian citizen, you never leave. And we were afraid that after the war is over, we won't be able to leave. So we waited there about 3 months in a camp, And what the Russians did is they imported about 1.5 million Poles, with among them about 300,000 Jews, to Russian work camps. And those war camps were basically in Siberia. So we, the first trip that we had all together is in a cattle car all the way to St. Petersburg, at that time Leningrad. We stayed there for a couple days, and then they sent us to Arkhangelsk, which is the northern part of Europe in Russia by the Finnish border. It was cold, very cold there. However, we were given a place to stay on a farm, and we worked on the farm. Everybody in the family worked on the farm, and it wasn't too bad. It, at least we had enough to eat, and nobody was shooting at us, and it was a strange and weird place, because 3 months of the year it was all dark. You could hardly see what was done, and then there was mosquito season, and then there was, the seasons were divided between the creatures that were that occupied the area for thousands and thousands of years. It was a forest mainly, and people worked either in lumbering or they worked on the farms. My mother was one of those interesting women. She was a survivor in the truest sense of the word. What she did is she had to take care of some cows for the town. And what she did is she used to steal the milk from the cows, share it with the commissars, and that way she got away with it. And that made it possible for us to get through the winter. Also stole the potatoes from the farm and other things. And we thought if this was going to be how the war is going to spend the war, we thought it would be okay. But then, for some odd reason, they started to relocate all the Poles that came deported to those towns down further down in Siberia. And the reason was for that is that the Russians, when they, although they were friends with the Germans, they knew there's going to be an attack. So they started moving their manufacturing from the Ukraine, from Belarus, from all these little towns, which were once part of Poland, all the way down to Central Asia, Samarkand, Uzbekistan, Turkestan, all these areas. And of course they needed raw labor for that. And we were that raw labor to get into this town. And in 1941, just as the Germans attacked the Soviet Union, we were loaded on a train in Arkhangelsk, and they were shipping us to Samarkand. Samarkand from Arkhangelsk is about 7,000 miles, all the way across the breadth and width of the Soviet Union. And there were cattle cars, but they were not as bad as the first trip with the German cattle cars. The cattle cars were larger, there were less people there, but still, no, nothing, no bathrooms, nothing. A bathroom was a slit in the floor. Life was very difficult on those trains. And it's so, our luck at that time was not very good, because we ran into the war. And when the Germans attacked the Russians, within 3 weeks they were off Leningrad. And they put a siege on Leningrad, which lasted about 900 days. And in Leningrad was just unbearable. And on the way to Samarkand, we got stuck. in Leningrad. Leningrad is St. Petersburg now. And I have never seen life as unbearable as it was then. People were dying on a daily basis. People were eating rats. There was hardly a rat left in town. And the only relief that they had is during wintertime, there's a lake in Leningrad that froze over, and when it froze over, you could move stuff back and forth. But it was very tough life. After that, we managed to move on the train out of Leningrad, and we went on the Trans-Siberian Line. The Trans-Siberian Line is goes all the way from St. Petersburg all the way to Vladivostok, which is on the Japanese on the Japanese border there. And that's across 11 time zones, about 11,000 kilometers, which is about 7,000 miles. And that journey is a memorable event in our life. My younger brother, I had a brother, one young brother that we came to Arkhangelsk, but my second brother was born in Arkhangelsk. We stayed in Arkhangelsk a year before we moved on, and he was just a baby. So my mother, father, and her two babies went on the train from Arkhangelsk all the way on our way to Samarkand. We wound up in St. Petersburg for about a year. Over a month. We helped build the fences. We were parked. We just lived right on the train. And then one day they said, okay, there's a corridor that you can go through around Moscow and get on the Trans-Siberian Line and go all the way to Samarkand. When we got on the train, the journey was tough. But when my mother and father worked together, they managed to get by. The idea is when the train stopped, we can go out there and barter for food, because food was the main problem, main concern for everybody. I and a couple other friends had the job of collecting the coal from under the trains when the train was stopped, because they had a little butt-belly stove, so you could warm something up. I used to barter for potatoes and for other things. So when the trains would stop, the people on the train would barter. Some of the people, including my parents, brought with them silverware and, you know, all the valuables they had, tablecloths, anything that would be bartered for food. And that way, they made their way through it by bartering for very food. And it also happened that the journey happened during the wartime. So the Germans would come with their planes and they would bark and they would bomb on the trains. And one time we were coming up to a destination where the train was bombed by the Germans. And then we saw people parts, animal parts, everything all over the place. And they put us into asking us to help clean the lines. It was amazing how the townspeople and everybody would come out. And after a bombing, and within a couple of days, it was cleaned and everything was put together, and we were ready to go. Life on the train was probably very difficult to explain, simply because we were divided into groups. There were the Jews and there were the Poles, and those are the two groups there were. But since we did not wanted to become Russian citizens, so they had categorized us as Poles, which was lucky for us because the Jews were treated differently than the Poles. So the Russian authorities gave everybody ration cards for the train. And every person had to have an ID and a ration card. And the ration card meant life or death. The ration cards would give us about 500 grams of bread every day, every other day, sometimes every third day. So between that, and we had to figure out how to barter for food. I remember one interesting incident. My mother was always concerned about milk for the baby. And we stopped in one little town along the Trans-Siberian Railroad, and they both jumped off, and they were trying to barter for some milk. And my mother got this can of milk, and all of a sudden the whistle blew, and the train was taking off. And everybody jumped on the train, and she was short, so she couldn't quite make it. So she took that cup, put her shawl around it, put the milk on the train. Two guys jumped off, shoved her into the train, and she looked in there. The milk was still there, and then all of a sudden a big hurrah came from everybody. So you can imagine. You can imagine how life was gone. The interesting thing is, somehow the anti-Semitism against Jews and the anti-feeling of Jews against Poles has disappeared in that thing. Everybody realized that we are pretty close to the same. We're in the same boat. We have the same problems. And their life had to continue. And for the first, the journey from Arkhangelsk to Samarkand lasted 3 months, and including 1 month that we spent in Leningrad. And when we got about halfway, my dad, jumped off the train to barter for some food, and he never came back. And then life got difficult for my mother. She had two children, one in her breastfed, and me, and my Herschel, which was my younger brother. And the thing that the worst thing that happened is when he left, he took all the ration cards with him, all the identification cards, and couldn't get any bread or anything. We had to rely on people who were starving themselves to share with us. So that was a terrible thing. At certain stops she went off, she was trying to beg, but she wasn't very good at it. So we, little by little, even the soldiers had a little bit, were sorry for her, and when the soup came up, they didn't bother to ask if she has the card or not. You know, they'd helped. And then an incident happened on the train. There was a woman who had two children, and she had ration cards and everything else. And one of her children died when he was trying to get some coal under the train, and another died later. So she gave my mother her cards, ration cards, and she says, "I have nothing to live for." And she jumped at that incoming train. She was killed. That was very difficult thing, and it sticks with me always. But anyways, we managed to get to Samarkand. The journey was difficult and hard because military trains were moving back and forth, so we were constantly on the sideline waiting for an open track. And eventually we got there 3 months later. And in Samarkand, on the last day, my younger brother died. And we had to figure out a way to find a place to bury him. And interestingly enough, there was a cemetery not too far where we got off the train on Samarkand, Uzbekistan. And there we found someone to say a few words in Hebrew and bury him. But we couldn't bury him separately. They wanted to do it together, so they grabbed all the children and they put them all together in a grave. So now we are in Samarkand. In Samarkand, my mother managed to get papers. She went, there's a Polish consul, because at that time Poland and Russia had a pact. They were both against the Germans. So all of a sudden, we weren't Russian prisoners, we were allies. And she got her paperwork so she could get a job in the place. And she did get a decent job picking cotton. But not only picking cotton, but taking out the seeds from the cotton. Anybody that ever picked cotton, that's a tough job. But picking out the seeds from the cotton doesn't get any tougher. But at least she had a job and she had a place to put me and my younger brother, because they had someone taking care of us. And then after a while, she was fortunate enough where she got, they were making a propaganda film. And then the propaganda film, they were looking for young pretty women from Poland, so they can show on the propaganda how Polish people are helping the Soviet Union with the war effort. So she got a much better job, and then she could put us into a children's home, a Detski Sadik. That's what a children's home is called in Russian. And there, Herschel and I were on our own. She was to come by after work, bring us some food, but generally we were on our own. And life in a children's home was very tough. You had to be tough to survive, because everybody was hungry and every piece of bread was accounted for. And if you were weak, they would take it from you. And they used to pick on my brother. So I learned how to fight, how to survive. And we did quite well. Then about a year later, the Polish culture had several Polish homes for Polish children. It was designed for Polish orphan children, but my mother was pretty good at bribing people, and I got in. My brother died of typhus before we can get into the Polish home, so I was there alone. And there, we sort of developed our own group of young boys. There was three of us that became very close friends, and we constantly fought to survive. The interesting thing about it is that the children of that home was sponsored by America. It was the United Jewish Fund, I think, that was sponsoring those. So we had a little better quality of life there. But it was still a question of survival. So we put together a group, and we decided, the three of us, that we were going to go and steal food. And we did. There was a big garden there, not too far from the children's home. And we used to crawl under the fence. And during summer, particularly, we used to get fruits. And somehow we managed to survive there by stealing fruit. My mother was really a genius and all that. She got a job afterwards in a factory, in a tobacco factory. And the tobacco factory was one of those jobs that made her independent. By that I mean, she would, and a couple of her friends would steal tobacco. And tobacco was a currency in the Soviet Union. And the way she did it is she had everybody involved in the theft. So when she took something, she shared it with everybody that looked the other way. And that way she managed to get me into this Polish children's home and come over periodically with food and other things to keep us alive. The biggest obstacle to survival there was, of course, for children was typhus, malaria, all those children diseases. And when people are malnourished, especially children, it is very difficult to survive. But the three of us managed to do quite well. One time, we had a couple instances where we came close to getting the end. There was a farm not too far from our place, and we used to go at night and raid the fields. And one time we saw a Russian soldier and an Uzbek fight, and the Russian soldier stabbed the guy, and he threw his knife away. And we weighed it. I picked up the knife. We cleaned it, and that was our weapon over there. And it came in handy several times. One time, we were coming back with an apples that we stole from a truck, and on his back, who was drunk, came up there. He grabbed our apples, and he says, "You guys are thieves, and he is going to show me how they treat thieves in Samarkand." He had a curved knife like that. He took a swing and caught me right here, and I grabbed my neck, my knife, and I stabbed him in the throat several times, and he fell down. We put him back on a donkey that he was riding, and the donkey took him away. And the next day, the police came. They were looking for if someone saw what was happening, but they say these Uzbek fight all the time. this time he got a hold of someone tougher. And that was the end of the story. Another time, which is much later, one of our friends, we had a place in Samarkand, which was behind a latrine that we used to gather. And we used to gather there because it was warm in the morning. And that's where we used to make our plans, what we're going to do the next day. And we called it Argentina. And the reason we called it Argentina is because of a book someone had about Argentina, where a young boy worked in a garden and how happy he was, so we called it Argentina. Of course, it didn't smell that good. But anyways, it was our turn. When the soldiers were coming back from the front, they would kidnap children. And we were in a place that didn't have any fences or anything around. So we were sitting there behind the fence, and all of a sudden we hear screaming one of our friends, and we got the knife, and we figured out where they were going to go, and we waited for him, and then when he passed by here with my friend and a sack on his head, we stabbed him several times in the leg, and he just took off limping, and we saved our friend. Afterwards, when I thought about it, where the heck did we get the nerve to do that? But, you know, you do strange things when you don't think about the consequences. Anyways, we managed to survive Samarkand. When the war ended in 1946, they took all the children and they shipped us all back to Poland. My mother went separately from us. And when we came back to Poland, we were in a house. And my friends, both of them, one found his father, came to for him, and the other one, his mother, came for him. And I was sitting there in the principal's office, and she came, "Your father's here." I said, "My father? I thought he was dead." Sure enough, he survived the war, and he was there. My mother came by train about a week later. But the problem was, by then he was married, and he had two children. So when, and I, at that time, I really didn't realize what was happening. I just thought that the woman was a sister, not his wife, and the children were the children of the sister. So I fitted right in there. And then when my mother came, she was told that your husband is here. And she came over to the house, she didn't even want a place to stay. She says, "Well, if my husband is here I'm going to stay." Well, when she opened the door and she saw what was going on, it didn't take her long to figure out that this weren't just a sister. And she looked at him, she spit him in the face, and she said, "You are responsible." But anyways, in war, a lot of things happen. So the next thing she wanted to do is to get a get, which is a divorce. Because without a get, in an Orthodox Jewish world, you don't get married again. And he didn't want to do it. And then at that time in Poland, the authorities, the Jewish rabbis still had some authority where they can throw someone into jail. So they threw him into jail. So after he got out of jail, he says, well, okay, I'll give her a get, but I have to stay with him. I can't go. By that time, in the last few months, my mother met her father, my father, who became my father, Kleinberg. He was born in Galicia, which is now Ukraine, I think. No, it's Austria. Well, no, it's Ukraine now, Galicia. It's Galicia, and he was sitting there on a chair, and my mother, he saw my mother, and they were both despondent. And he said that he lost his two children, his wife. The Russians came in, grabbed them, and he had to walk all the way from Galicia, from Breslov, all the way to Siberia. That's where he spent the years. So they decided that maybe it's time that they become friends. The thing is that my mother couldn't read or write in any language. And he was a learned man. He could write Yiddish, German, and she needed the help. Someone tell him what's going on. And little by little, they got together and they decided that they will leave Poland. Of course, you know, in spite, and the thing that was probably most discouraging about Poland is when the Jews came back, our Polish neighbors made it abundantly clear that they didn't want us there under any circumstances. There were several pogroms which they killed people, Jews that came back to claim their property. So it was very apparent that there's no way that you can stay in Poland. And as Jews have done for hundreds of times, packed their bags and they moved, and they moved on. And this is what we decide to do. But the first thing was the get. So she got together with the rabbi of that town, and they forced them to get a get. And the next day they came and picked me up, and we moved on. There was only three places to go at that time. Actually, one place, West Germany. So out of all places, we packed our bags, we walked, we took trains, and we ended up in a DP camp in Germany. Now, you must remember that after the war, Germany was divided into four zones. They had American zones, British zone, the Russian zone, and the French zone. And we ended up in the American zone, which was lucky for us. And they put us in a DP camp. And we had to wait till they liquidated the DP camps before we could come here. And in the DP camp, they got married and had two children. And on May 14, 1951, we packed our bags and we ended up in America. And that was actually by chance. We were signed up to go to Israel. When we got to the shipyard, they didn't have any room. The ship went off. Then we were transferred to Australia, and that boat has also passed us. So we ended up on the Black and Rich, and we came to America. And that was May 14, 1951. And that's part of the story. I hope I didn't make it too bad, but I tried. Hope I didn't embarrass you.
One of the most difficult things is when an individual starts to tell their story. It's different to write it down. And I think this was one of your first times really speaking in a large group, wasn't
yes.
it? And I know every single one of you appreciates so much the effort and how important it is to share with us, for us to bear testimony, to bear witness, and to hear these stories and be able, it's not just a story, it's your life. And now we've shared a little bit of that experience, and we really, truly appreciate it.
Am I running out of time?
You have plenty of time. You are perfect.
Well, let me add some other interesting event that happened.
Please.
My children, I have six children. I have six. I have two children, and my daughter lives in Israel, and she has six children. So they're my six grandchildren. And the idea from this book started from two sources. In Israel, when they go to high school, they send them to Auschwitz to show them what the concentration camps look like. And every time they used to go there, usually the night before, they asked me, he says, Grandpa, I'm going to be not too far where you were born. Can you write us something? And I would panic and write them. And they would read it before their friends. And they all said that they appreciate the information. So they were after me all the time to write down my story. And another thing that happened when I was 70 years old, no, 65 years old, I applied for Social Security benefits. And the Social Security Administration wanted to have my birth certificate. And I said, well, I don't have one. Everything was destroyed during the war. So they gave me an address to Polish embassy to write. And in that Polish embassy, they should be able to issue you a birth certificate. I said, but the documents were destroyed. She says, you'll be surprised. Well, I had no idea that anything would come of it. But wouldn't you believe I get a Polish birth certificate, written in Polish, by the way, telling him that I was born on January 28, 1937. Because up till that day, I always celebrated my birthday January 1st. Always thought I was January 1st. So now I got two birthdays. For Social Security, I have my January 28th, and when everything else, my licenses and everything else is January 1st. So I have to think, when am I born, when people ask me. But another thing, the advantage of having the birth certificate is I learned the spelling of my mother's maiden name, of my father's name. Can you imagine trying to find my mother's maiden name? Hopcha. That's her name, Hopcha. You can't even sneeze it right. And my father's name was Yehosko, and also had maiden name. And so that gave me an idea. See if I can find someone that would find our ancestry. And sure enough, at the we looked at a Hadassah magazine, and there was Michael Goldstein, who says that's what he does for a living. So I called him up, and I says, could you find out what happened to Aaron Kleinberg? Because as far as I was concerned, I only had one father. And he did. I gave him my first father's name, which was Haskell Davidovich, and Aaron Kleinberg was my current father, and some other basic information. And about 6 weeks later, I get a call from him. He says, I have some very good friends, and their name is Davidovich, and they live in Israel, not too far from him. So I says, you got to be out of your mind. And sure enough, I asked them if they could write something that I would know. And in the correspondence, some of the things that they said, I knew it couldn't be anybody else. Because my birth father loved pigeons. And every place he went, he did something with pigeons. And when they said that, the pigeon guy is my father. So I knew right away. So then we were going to a wedding. My grandson, that's in 209, I think it was. Yeah. Our grandson, Zevi, was getting married in Jerusalem. And they wanted to meet with me. And I wanted to meet with them. So Michael arranged in his home a meeting for all of us to get together. So here walk in there, four sisters and one brother I didn't know I had. I did know about two of the girls. After the war, I met them in Breslau. They were babies, and I was pushing them around in the carriage. And they remembered me, of all things. But anyways, after we hugged and cried, we said we are going to keep contact. And I told them, I asked them if they would all write down what happened during those years. And I said, I will. So that and my children insisting that I leave him the legacy of family history, I finally did it. And I took almost a year that I was, 210 was the year that I wrote this down. But I never thought that it would catch on beyond me. The book reads a lot better than I speak, I'll show you that.
Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for coming.
Okay.
You've been listening to a program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Holocaust survivor Milton Kleinberg, owner and chief executive officer of Senior Market Sales Incorporated in Omaha, Nebraska, which employs over 100 people in four states and two countries, the United States and Israel, and author of Memories of My Childhood, During and After the Holocaust, 1937 to 1951, which traces Mr. Kleinberg and his family's escape from Nazi-occupied Poland in 1939 and their subsequent capture and internment in the Soviet Union. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Sunday afternoon, July 8, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to former executive director of the Institute for Holocaust Education, Beth Selden Doton, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. We'd like to send a special thank you to Beth for all of her encouragement and assistance over the years in our efforts to record and broadcast survivors of the Nazi Holocaust in order to get their message to as wide an audience as possible, in the hopes that by broadcasting these programs, we might, in a small way, help to prevent hate and bigotry from dictating the actions of those claiming to have open minds and to exercise religious tolerance. We wish Beth all the best in her move to Israel. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.